We made this.
Welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and welcome along again to our Season 3 coverage of Millennium. And joining me this week to talk about borrowed time is Darren Mooney. Darren, we're still in this midst of COVID-19 and all that lark. I'm getting quite bored of talking about it now, but in yourself, how are you doing? How are things going?
All work and no play makes Darren talk about Millennium Season 3, it turns out. So I'm quite okay.
Good. So it's all a bit up in the air. So I'm glad that you're doing well. What have you been up to? I mean, I know we would normally talk about this at the end about what podcasts and stuff like that you've got going. But what have you been up to in the last few weeks with your podcast and stuff? I think you've got a good thing going on, which was meant to be the summer, but is now the autumn.
Yes. Kind of well, stuff, I mean, like everything else has been massively delayed. So yeah, not to get too specific and not to kind of ruin the illusion that listeners, we are broadcasting live right into your ears. When we recorded this, I was actually in the midst of recording on the 250, the Summer of Scorsese, which Kurt will have by the time you've listened to this, joined us to discuss Shutter Island. But it's basically an encompassing look at Martin Scorsese's career as documented on the IMDb 250 and occasionally with a bit of detours here and there. So covering everything from Taxi Driver to Kundun to Gangs of New York to The Departed up to The Wolf of Wall Street. And our old episode, The Irishman, as well. And basically kind of just taking a look at that with a bunch of guests. It was something we've been planning since like 2019. Because, you know, the joke, it's the summer of score. Sazy, summer. That was the entire joke behind it. Unfortunately, we kind of missed summer with the whole, you know, I mean, everybody missed summer, but we kind of missed summer as well. So we kind of, ironically, we kicked off in the first week of September, literally within inches of actually being a summer podcast just about. But no, the season's ongoing. We're really enjoying it. It's really great fun. I'm also doing some other stuff as well. Actually, I've been very, very lucky. I think I mentioned that I do The Escapist now. I write for The Escapist, yes, which is an American kind of pop culture website. It's great. They've had some wonderful talent over there over the years. Like, for example, Kieran Gillen, who would be one of my favorite comic book writers, actually began as a games critic there. I'm not a video games critic, which is great. I should have that little badge. Darren Mooney, I'm not a video games critic, but I am writing
about...
Good
to see you do that, though.
I mean, I imagine that it would be terrible, but it would be great fun. But no, I am covering pop culture for them. So films, television, comics, that sort of stuff, just general pop culture, the industry as well. And I've launched I'm doing a podcast with the fantastic Bob Chipman, the wonderful and generous Jack Packard as well, at The Escapist, where weekly we talk about the week in film news. So you can listen to us there. And I also have launched a video series with The Escapist as well, In the Frame. So I've been writing columns about pop culture twice a week. Now I'm writing columns twice a week, and then the Monday column will also come with an accompanying video as well. So you can kind of watch that on YouTube if you want to hear my dulcet tones talk about something related to, I don't know, off the top of my head, you know, Black Panther. We talked about with the passing Chadwick Boseman. We talked about The Rise of Skywalker with kind of news around that, for example. And we're doing a nice one on the directorial style of Christopher Nolan, I hope, at some point. So you can listen to those as well if you want. If you don't get enough of Darren talking nonsense on your Millennium podcast, you can check all those out as well. But no, it's good. It's interesting. It's one of those situations where I feel like I am being tremendously lucky in a way that very, very few people are at the moment. So I'm very, very thankful for that, to be absolutely honest, in that, like, you know, the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic, we're in the middle of lockdown, and these opportunities have kind of presented themselves, so I've got no excuse not to try this stuff, which is, you know, a very rare privilege that people have. I mean, I'm also admittedly also very lucky in that I'm able to work from home for my job as well. I'm very, very mindful that, like, as taxing and as exhausting and as draining as the past 6 months have been, I'm very privileged and very, very lucky to be in the position that I am about it. I always kind of like when we talk about COVID, and it's like, I am exhausted, I am tired, I am lonely, I am locked away from the world. I'm always mindful of the fact that, like, I am much better position than a lot of people due to just luck and various other factors. So, you know, I don't want to lose sight of that, basically. But yeah, no, I'm in a very, I'm trying new things, and maybe not all of them will work, but I'm very thrilled to have the chance to do that, basically, is where I'm at. With COVID.
There's nothing wrong with throwing ideas up in the air and seeing which one lands, put it that way.
Yeah.
Because that's the way that we did live streaming back in my work. Obviously, it's not happening at the moment, but one of the managers that we had a few years back had a multitude of marvelous ideas. He's like the Chip Johannesson of,
of retail of management, work. Yeah.
He's got very many, many, many mad and insane ideas. But yeah, the live streaming one landed.
Good.
And you're talking about you know, the fact of being able to try new things and stuff. One of the things that we do in our induction back into work for those people who have been off and have come back in, unfortunately, that's not been that many people just yet, but is that we ask what's been positive, what's been a positive spin on how this has all happened. It's not all doom and gloom. Where have you done it? And some of the stories you get are really interesting. You know, it's like people who are stretching themselves, who have gone and done other jobs, or they have, you know, they've decorated the entire house, or they've cleaned stuff that they wouldn't have cleaned in decades and stuff. So it is nice to hear those different things. And everyone at some point, hopefully, you know, most people have managed to find some positives. And obviously there is negatives to it, and we appreciate that. But it's just nice that, you know, some people have managed to find other things to do, and obviously yourself is a case in point as well. But speaking of Chip Johannesson, we need to talk about Millennium. So I think we're on a bit of time. Time's running out, you know, and this time is precious. We don't get it again unless it's borrowed. Yeah, so we're talking about Borrow Time. Season 3, episode 10 was aired on the 15th of January 1999. As alluded to, it's written by Chip Johannesson, and it was directed by Dwight Little. And I did notice, actually, at the end, the story editor is Rendell and Meyer were actually involved in story editing as well, which I didn't notice before. Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting episode, and I would personally say, with all the episodes that's gone before it, probably the best that we've got so far.
Yes.
What is your... I don't even need to ask you the question anymore. I think you would agree with that. But what do you make to this episode in the run, as we always do, up until this point? You know, we've talked about another episode earlier on, which we do not name.
Listeners, it was 13 years later.
Yeah, exactly. We might talk about it in 13 years. What do you make to this one then? And what would you rate out of 10? And then we'll jump in straight into the IMDb.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I no secret here that there's no real love lost between me and, say, the first half of the third season, in large part because it feels like the show is not sure what it wants to be, what it wants to do, and how it wants to do it. And I think that, you know, again, I think that bringing, say, Michael Duggan on board, who tried to do interesting things, and who was, I think, very much trying to push the show back into the mold of kind of a classic Law and Order, police procedural kind of thing going on as well. I don't think it worked, and I'm not sure that Duggan ever entirely understood the show that he was writing for. I mean, I would argue that, like, Human Essence, his last script for the show, the 8th episode of the season, is one of the worst episodes of Millennium ever. And it's coming after a run of episodes that are competing for worst episode of Millennium ever as well. And I mean, again, like, to be clear, there are people who enjoy the third season, and I'm really, really glad that they do. And I also genuinely think that there's actually really good critical discussion to be had about that. And I'm kind of glad that you're only bringing me back in now, because it's like, okay, Now I have something good and positive and interesting to say.
Yeah,
but I
had to do that, Darren. I had to do that. I couldn't give the audience any room for maneuver on that. Yeah. We had to delay your appearance back on for a while.
Sorry, Darren. Listening to Darren hammer on about how much he hates Human Essence is going to be a very soul destroying experience for him. No. I mean, again, I'm glad people enjoy that. I understand that there are people for whom this sort of stuff works for them. And I mean, you've had Chris Knowles on, and his writing on the third season is absolutely amazing. And I will hardly recommend that. It's given me an appreciation for it that I didn't have before. But for me, like, those first 8 episodes of the third season are really, really, really tough to get through. I mean, I think, you know, that episode We Do Not Name 13 years later, I said, and I meant it, that it was the best episode in those first, like, 10 episodes. Best episode between The Time Is Now and Borrowed Time is, like, 13 years later. And I think I gave that a 4 out of 10. Which gives you a sense of how I feel about the rest of the season around it. And I mean, Omerta, which I think is written by Michael Lord Perry, is the Christmas episode. It's not good, but at least it's bad in interesting ways. But Borrowed Time, I do genuinely really, really like this one. So listeners can sigh with a bit of relief there. I think that there's genuinely a lot of interesting stuff happening here. I think it's genuinely ambitious. I think it's doing something new and interesting. I think it is a bit muddled. I think it's a little bit unfocused. But I think that you're entirely right to single out Chip Johannesson as a point of kind of interest here, because he very much himself and Ken Horton step into that role of producer after Michael Duggan leaves, and they begin guiding the rest of the show. And you start seeing a lot of the key episodes of the season begin to be kind of shaped by Johannesson, particularly in collaboration with other writers. And I mean, I have a huge soft spot for later in the season episodes like Saturn Dreaming of Mercury, or even Bardo Thodol, which, you know, I'm not even sure I understand what they are about or what they're doing or what the stories or what like literally happens on screen as I'm watching the episodes. But they're very atmospheric. They're very moody, and they're very much informed by this idea of kind of like Johannesson pushing his own interests into the show and pushing the show towards his own interests in turn. And again, that's the thing with Borrowed Time, is that for the first time in the third season, it feels like there is genuinely life being breathed into the show. It feels like the show is kind of coming alive. It's kind of waking up in interesting ways. Notably, this is really the first time in the third season that you see significant engagement with what happened in the second season. And Johannesson, again, is one of those writers who has worked on all three seasons of Millennium. So, you know, he knows the show inside and out. He is, I would argue, one of the show's formative writers. I was very lucky to talk to you about Force Majeure, his first script, of his first scripts for the show. I think he wrote Blood Relatives before that as well. But like Force Majeure, a Chip Johannesson script, is one of the most kind of like defining moments in terms of the first season of Millennium, because it's the moment where it goes, this is something unique, distinct, and deeply, deeply unusual, and not at all what I expected from the basic premise of Millennium. Like, I can't make what I've just watched fit in the pattern of the pilot. And it's great because it pushes the boundaries of what Millennium can be. And so it's great to see him coming to Borrowed Time and taking it and acknowledging, you know, the second season, which he's talked in interviews and he's been candid about it. Himself and Ken Horton were not huge fans of the direction, you know, in which Morgan and Wong kind of steered the show. And look, I would disagree with that. I think the second season is one of the best seasons of television ever. But I mean, I understand that. I can understand why it's not everybody's cup of tea. And I genuinely respect Johannesson for, with Borrowed Time and with later episodes in the season, you get a sense of him trying to make the show work with what he's been given, as opposed to the first stretch of the season where there's a very real impetus or real sort of like push to make the show work by ignoring what came before, in that it genuinely feels with Borrowed Time that Johannesson is engaging with the climax or the end of the previous season, albeit in a way that is kind of indirect and abstract and metaphorical and thematic rather than kind of literal and explicit and like bluntly stated in terms of narrative dynamics. So yeah, no, I really, really like Borrowed Time. I do think it's messy. I think it's clunky. I think that it's the point at which you can see that like 20th Century Fox have given up on the show, in terms of production value and production budget, and particularly the use of CGI and special effects. It's the point at which, if you're watching the show, it really feels like Millennium has kind of been pushed down in terms of priorities for the network. Now, I mean, admittedly, you know, behind the scenes that that's very much the case. The show itself was ironically on borrowed time at this point. But watching it, even the teaser, it's like, it's astounding to me that this was something that was broadcast, you know, on television in late 1998 or early 1999, because it looks like an 80s episode of Doctor Who at times. But yeah, no, outside of those concerns, I think that there's a lot to recommend it, and I really, really, really enjoy it.
Right, well, let's see what the difference is then between, because there's a lot of things that I want to catch up on when what you've said there after this, but your rating and what you think, as we always do with yourself, you think maybe it got on IMDb.
Okay, for me, I'm going to go with I've been dreading this question all day. I've been bouncing between a 6 and a 7. Now, keep in mind, I gave, you know, like 13 years later, a 4, which is, I think, was one of the only times I graded a Millennium episode below 5. I think maybe I'll stretch to a 7 for this. I'll be generous. I don't know whether that's in point of comparison to the episodes around it or in like a general sense in terms of Millennium, but 7 feels like a good number for this episode, I think. And in terms of what IMDb gave it, damn it, Kurt, you have me at a disadvantage. When I was on doing the second season, it was like, you know, I knew what the last episode got. I knew what the next episode got. I knew what the fan consensus was. I have no grounding whatsoever for Borrowed Time. So I'm just going to throw a number out randomly. I'm going to go with 6.7.
Right. Okay. Do you want to invert those numbers?
Really? 7.6? Yeah. Okay. I can go with that. Yeah, that's pretty.
It was in your head. Yeah. That's all I'll
say. A very third season, like effect Darren getting the right numbers, but in the wrong order. It feels like a very third season Millennium kind of vibe to have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the time before it, Immersa got 7.4 and Human Essence got 6.4.
Okay.
And it was based on 189 votes. Now, surprisingly enough, Immersa got 205 votes. And
that's Christmas. It's a Christmas hit.
It is Christmas. It is Christmas. And then you've got Borrowed Time at 189. The thing about Borrowed Time for me is that, and it goes to the actual opening of the episode as well, it's that, yeah. The whole thing is you can tell it's a Chip Johannesson beast in that it's very kind of dream logic, ethereal, especially that opening scene with the priest and Jordan's body, and the fact it keeps jumping between
the cross cutting,
the train and stuff. Yeah, so it's and it has that over the whole episode, it has that dream kind of feel and, as I say, ethereal kind of thing, and it's one that gets me quite. It gets me emotive as well, especially some of the scenes with it, which we'll talk about throughout the show. I mean, one of the things that, like the Innocence and Exegesis talks about is the mother daughter relationship, and obviously Frank and Jordan's relationship is touched upon quite a lot in season three, for obvious reasons, because that's what's left. It's probably my favorite episode up to this point. Yeah. And it only gets stronger from here as well in a lot of ways. But it does. It's a marvelous episode. I think 7.6 is good, because I would give it around about an 8. To be fair, I think it's really understand. And I get what you're saying with some of the things of, does it really make sense and what was that about and things.
You've been watching a Chip Johannesson episode. It's like one of those, like, check exactly. This. If you're stroking your chin and going, what the hell just happened, but feel vaguely satisfied, you've been watching a Chip Johannesson episode.
Correct, and that's exactly how a Chip Johannesson episode makes me feel. I'm sure we'll talk about that, because there's some questions that I have about it, which you won't be able to answer.
I was about to say, I love the idea, and you're very optimistic, Kurt. It's like, I have some questions. That's great, Kurt. I also have some questions.
I think most people would have some questions. So let's talk about those questions then. Let's look deeper into Borrowed Time. So straight off the bat, I'm going to get this out of the way first, okay? Is the effects of that train, of that water, is by far one of the worst things I have ever seen in my entire life.
Yes, it is. That docks a point for me. It would be a solid 8 out of 10 if it didn't have that shot. And it's so terrible, because you have to imagine, like, again, it's a Fox TV show. You have to have stock footage. Like, I don't care if you're playing footage from, like, Superman in 1980. It's better than what you're using here. Like, a little model railway and the train just, like, falls over. And I would be more invested in that than whatever the hell it is. It's like a Dutch angle on a bunch of gray squares with, like, blue static in the, like, bottom right hand corner of the screen. It's bottom left hand corner. It's very, very ugly, and it's so distracting, particularly because, like, the sequences leading up to it, they do have stock footage of, like, a real train, and, like, the fact that the set is not perfect. The set is, like, again, it feels very, I mentioned that, you know, the special effects, the CGI looks like it's from, 1980s Doctor Who. Like, the sets do have that kind of, like, they look like they're from 1960s television, in that, like, it doesn't look like a train carriage. It looks more like what we could afford to construct that might look like a train carriage, using, like, a bunch of wood that we found lying around and some plastic that we sculpted. But it is, like, it's, That at least is reasonably effective. And the idea of kind of, like, I like the water tank effect as well, like, which looks like genuine production value that you get later on as well. But it's just, it really does look very cheap. It really does look like, you've reached the point with Millennium where nobody is. And again, like, you could argue that it's probably down to the fact that the one imagines And again, I feel really bad. Like, I don't know Michael Duggan. And I'm like, he's a very private man. I've never read any interviews with him about Millennium. So I feel like I'm laying a lot at his doorstep. But one wonders if, like, part of the reason why Borrowed Time looks so cheap is because the innocence and
money
that's
was spent.
It exactly where, yeah. where money was spent in, like, the innocence and eggs of Jesus with that gigantic plane crash. And even that gigantic plane crash, like, it just looks like a knockoff of Max and Tempest Fugit. It's like the worst place that you could spend money. Like, on the third season of Millennium, is reminding people that it's a cheaper version of The X-Files. Like, it's literally the worst way you could... Sorry, I feel really bad that it's like, I really like this episode, but I'm still going to go rip into the third season.
This is why I'm getting this out of the way first, you see, because then we can talk about the good stuff later, so it's all good.
It really does. Like, part of me wonders, so maybe, is it that the budget had been slashed so much and Fox had given up on the show? Was it internally because they allocated money so haphazardly to the season premiere? And again, like, spending a lot of money on the season premiere is a standard piece of television budget, but like not to the extent that you're still paying for it 10 episodes later, like when you want to do a train crash. It boggles the mind in some respects.
Yeah, well, it's good that you've said that, and you pretty much hit the nail on the head when you said that surely there's some stock footage elsewhere. In my notes, I've put borrowed effects ?
We can borrow time or we can borrow effects. We can do one, but not both.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so I just wanted to mention that because it jumps out at me every time that I've watched this episode that I almost forget just how bad it was. Yeah. Now, I did watch it on my tablet the other night, actually, and it didn't worry me too much, but I think it's because my tablet's quite a big one. And my eyes were really close to it, so I couldn't pass what I was seeing.
It looks very much like a 90s screensaver. Like, again, it looks like the kind of effect. Yeah. Like, remember when you get like a CD-ROM and it would have like, you know, live action actors in it, but it was like a click and play. You know, like those, it was a Phantasm or Phasmagorder, like those horror games that were kind of big in the late, again, in the late 80s and early 90s, where it was like, well, we have an actor and we have a green screen. We're going to make this work. That's what it feels like, except for some reason, it's like January 15th, 1999, and this is happening. The Matrix is arriving in cinemas in a few months, and this is happening. It's surreal.
Yeah. Well, having said that, I'm actually playing Command and Conquer, talking about video games like we did before. Command and Conquer had those blue screens.
Exactly.
It was brilliant.
But I mean, like, at least Command and Conquer, like, had, like, you know, was it Udo Kier in it as well, like, to make up for some of that. Yeah. Like, Udo Kier feels like an
games podcast. See, all you need to do is write a column on Command and Conquer and we'll be happy.
All set. Udo Kier, the Command and Conquer auteur.
Right, okay, let's get down to the seriousness now. I mentioned about the opening scene. What do you make to this? Because as I say, the juxtaposition between both and I think what adds to this is that it doesn't really say anything. So it's like you've got the last rites being read out and you've got the train, and it seems like both are disconjoined, really. And obviously the it's an in media res as well. So it's a way, it's like sort of how are these going to like come together in one story? So do you think it's a good enough one to keep people interested? Because for me, it felt, as I say, that dream logic, that ethereal kind of feeling, it felt like there was something, because I know, I've seen it obviously many times, but it does give you that kind of, that wandering feeling, that dream logic-y kind of feel to it, that very dream-esque kind of feel.
Yeah, I mean, after the kind of slog, again, sorry about this, but after the slog that it's been through the first 8 episodes, first 9 episodes of the season, like, a teaser that isn't literally you're about to sit through more and more violence and suffering and horror is probably, like, the best thing about Borrowed Time. It's like, this is odd. This is good. It's been a while since we've had a properly odd episode of like Millennium, excluding Omerta. And Omerta has its own problems, to be absolutely clear. This is a properly kind of surreal opening. And again, it's that juxtaposition that you mentioned, which is like, why are we seeing the train and why are we seeing the child? And then the child turns out to be Jordan, but the child in the train wasn't Jordan. So why are we being shown these two images out of context next to one another with that strange man? And again, like, you get a sense that, like, when Johannesson was writing it, that maybe he was kind of over-egging the pudding and there's going to be, like, more mystery and more engagement going on there. Because when we first see the man that we'll come to know as Samuel, he has a bruised and burst lip. And, you know, when a character in a film has an injury, it's generally to help you position it in terms of continuity, but also to make you ask questions. So, like, the real mystery is, why does that guy have a bruised lip? But, like, being honest, we don't know anything about him. So I'm not really that concerned at the fact he has a bruised lip. But I think there's something interesting there in terms of, like, taking that in media res kind of moment and pushing it back to the start, in large part because I can't imagine another way to kind of get into this story. Because you can't really do that with the first death where the woman kind of just keels over at the playground. That wouldn't work as a teaser in its own right because it's not necessarily odd enough. Maybe the fact she's coughing up water, but you need to get to the, like, autopsy scene to kind of get that aspect going. So no, I think the teaser works well enough. It's not the best Millennium teaser, and it's certainly not the best teaser of the third season. It's not as atmospheric as something like, say, The Sound of Snow, for example, just two episodes later. And it's not as kind of like, it doesn't grab you as hard as, say, Collateral Damage the very next episode. But it is a welcome return of oddness to the season. It's a welcome return of the kind of surreal, the unusual. And again, you mentioned that kind of dream logic as well. And even then, it's kind of like the oddness of it, the fact that you've got religion coming into it as well, those overhead shots as well. I think Dwight Little does, like, as much as he can with the budget that he has here as well, because you have that kind of nice atmosphere, the kind of, and again, the camera movement really conveys that sense of, like, that dream state. The camera is kind of, like, drifting and moving and flowing and kind of is overhead and then kind of settles into a position and stuff like that. So it's all very, very effective. I think that, you know, is this the best opening Millennium ever? No. Is it a good opening compared to the openings we've had recently? Yes. So I think it works. I think it works relatively well.
Yeah. I mean, while you're talking about some technical aspects as well, I think just while I remember is what I do like about some of the lighting in this episode is some of the things that's put in when it comes to Samuel, because when Frank looks down at him in the hospital, he's kind of like glowing in this white light. But when you're seeing him looking at Jordan just after the teaser here, and also in later parts, I think when Emma sees him, when she goes looking for him, he's got that, like, reflective light on him as well. Yeah. It's like, obviously it's like pointing to the audience, but I do like those little touches that they put in throughout the episode of him.
Yeah, even that shot of him at the train station with the kind of like, with the gas kind of and the smoke rising around him, which is like something from a film noir almost, or, you know, if you want to be cheeky and kind of dismissive, you could say it looks like something from a 90s boy band video, but it is effective and it is atmospheric and it kind of, it's rich and it gives you a kind of a mood. And, like, again, Millennium is a show, you know, I think it has a lot more than mood and atmosphere going on in it, but I think that, like The X-Files, mood and atmosphere is a large part of what sets it apart from a lot of contemporary television, and it's great to see it employed here well and with purpose, because I think, like, to be fair, there is a lot of atmosphere and a lot of mood in some of the earlier third season episodes. See, I can say nice things. Like, for example, I think that, you know, like Human Essence and kind of like Even Through a Glass Darkly have very strong senses of mood to them as well. But I think that what makes Borrowed Time kind of stronger is that mood is deployed with a bit more purpose, to be honest. Like, it's very clear, like, even... Okay, I say it's very clear, he says, while talking about Chip Johannesson's script. But, like, the fact that the episode is able to convey to you, like, what Samuel is, or what Samuel probably is, without anybody actually saying it out loud, without anybody mentioning the word angel out loud or explicitly in reference to him, without a sequence of a character reading through a book or looking at pictures or kind of like browsing biblical texts or kind of like having an exposition driven montage explaining what Samuel is like, to the credit of Johannesson as a scriptwriter, but also I think Little as a director in terms of how he positions and frames him. Like, I think both you and I have said it's not subtle what it does with Samuel, but it works. And that's a lot to recommend, particularly in the context of a script that is at times almost willfully opaque.
Just while we're here as well, what I particularly like about your review is that you allude to, and I know there's an episode coming up next episode to a certain character from another TV franchise, with a leather, it happens to wear a leather jacket and is has a some size down teeth, which I quite liked. And I have to admit, I did have a leather jacket that looked similar to Samuel's and Angel's.
It was the '90s,
so at that time, yeah. I did have that. I did wear that. I've got pictures of
prove. Shout out to Eric Mabius, by the way, who I think he's gone on to do work on like Ugly Betty and stuff like that. But he really is like the poor man's Dennis Quaid. And he's aged into that role remarkably well. Like, he is very much kind of like a teen angel. There's that, again, that weird thing that you have with kind of millennium and 90s culture, where it's almost like the 90s and the 50s coexisting, where you could almost imagine him on a motorbike, like chewing a toothpick. While traveling around the country and I guess rescuing people from like train crashes or something. But he kind of like, it's that weird, it's very, very strange combination of like iconography kind of stitched together. And I kind of like it.
Yeah, no, I actually quite like it as well. It's good. I also just, I wanted to touch upon just some of the things that's popped up in my head when watching this, and we'll talk about some.
I love that, like, this is borrowed time. It's like, we're going to talk about the story. We're going to talk about the lot. No, I'm just going to mention some things that popped into my head because that's safer. Yeah. I know what those things are.
this is a direct question. So I think because obviously we'll talk over this course of this episode of what we think this episode is. But things that came into my head when watching this today was like the very nature of the episode is about this is borrowed time. The fact that, you know, you're taking someone who's had the near death experience and is living on borrowed time and giving it to somebody else, and there's this abstract kind of discussion about why that happens. So it's like, you know, like, say for example 1919, for example, that has like, you know, the hope of the future of the children. Now that's abstract enough. You've got Innocence and Exegesis kind of alluding to the same sort of thing. In this one, it's very much, and in some ways I quite like it, the fact that it's not being by any stretch of the imagination overt with what it's trying to tell you, but there is this feeling of why were they chosen, why were those three people in that cabin the ones that have to be saved? Why is that girl there? And it doesn't answer those questions, but it does pose the question of, is it just the fact that the borrowed time needs to be passed on, or is there more to it, and is that person special in any way, or is it just the fact of having that borrowed time? Do you have any opinions on the reason for it?
No, and again, like you, I kind of like it, because, and again, this is one of the things with Millennium in general, and it arguably goes back to, you know, was it like Lamentation and Powers, Principalities, Thrones and Dominions, where you have the show doing like the big Millennium version of like the X-Files myth arc is like the Legion mythology in inverted commas, but it's this idea of kind of like this heavenly existential battle between forces that we cannot comprehend doing things that we do not understand in ways that exist beyond our, you know, beyond our capacity to grasp. And again, like on the X-Files, all of that gets exposited away through kind of voiceover monologues. And, you know, over the course of the show, we can like map the Syndicate family tree. And in case we weren't paying any attention, in the final episode of the X-Files, Mulder basically makes us sit down and watch his PowerPoint slide presentation of everything that he's done over the past 9 years, as he explains in great detail how it fit together. And there definitely was a plan. Shut up, people on the internet saying the X-Files didn't make sense for 90 minutes inexplicably. Whereas Millennium has always been more abstract and more willing to play kind of loose with that. And I've always liked that aspect of it. I don't think it works as well here as it did in Lamentation, Power, Principality, Thrones and Dominions, because I think that those two episodes were much better constructed and they were saying something that was much clearer about Frank and his relationship to evil and the idea that, you know, how evil works in the world and how it worms its way into your life and how you let it in and you accept it and how, you know, the path towards the light is dark, terrible and full of suffering. In contrast, Borrowed Time, as you point out, never explains why this stuff is happening. Never explains why these people in particular are the people who need to A, be saved, or like B, need to die in the first place. I mean, even the inciting incident for Jordan, like, it's heavily implied that like Jordan got her inverted commas trademark borrowed time when she had that kind of that outbreak when she sort of came to Seattle in the first place. So it's not like she's living on borrowed time since, you know, the plague at the end of the second season. This is just, you know, an event that we didn't see that happened off camera. And it just seems that, like, so how come, like, Frank never saw Samil before? How come Samil wasn't hanging around Jordan when she got that infection? How come he's only coming to visit her now for the first time, even though he's haunting the people in that train car and visiting the little girl? How does, like, any of this work in a, like, a simple, basic, mechanical sort of way? Like, does Samil have anybody that he, like, reports to? How does he communicate with the authorities that are, like, doing this? Is he himself making positive decisions about the apportioning? Or is he simply, like, a representative of some entity that we do not see or comprehend? And yeah, even as you mentioned, like, is there a reason why it was that particular car that was saved? Because presumably, as Samil was, like, taking the borrowed time from other people, and kind of, like, and how those people were chosen, seems to be because they got their own borrowed time. So it's like a pass it on, sort of like a really weird, yeah, dark pay it forward sort of thing. But why that, those three people in that carriage? And again, you have that tension that runs throughout. And again, to be fair to the episode, it's something that works really well on rewatch, because, like, the first time you're watching it, not that you're, you know, not confused on subsequent rewatches at all, but the first time you're watching it, You don't really understand why Samil seems to be, like, tense about the fact that there's this, you know, jerkish asshole sitting with them in the carriage early on. Whereas when on rewatch, it becomes clear because Samil doesn't think that man is supposed to survive. And he's wondering, like, if he's in the carriage with the mother and the little girl, does that mean that I'm doing this wrong? So when the man leaves and throws a little hissy fit about, I could walk there quicker, you know, that's kind of like a bit of relief to Samil, because it's like, okay, this is going according to the plan that I had. But the first time you're watching this episode, you don't know that he has a plan. You don't know why why he seems flustered and confused that this stranger is in the space, because everybody in that space is a stranger to us, the audience, and presumably to him, the character, as well. Like, why couldn't Samil, like, take a carriage, you know, or take a little compartment, one over, or one down, or one up, or in another carriage, or on another train? There's no real explanation or purpose or reason for it. And, you know, these are all valid reasons why I can see people going, this makes no sense, it doesn't matter, I've got no idea what's going on, it's not clearly explained, what the hell is Chip Johannesson on about? But at the same time, I think Millennium is a show that has done enough work with episodes like the ones that I mentioned, you know, with obviously Lamentation, Paris, Principalities, Thrones of Dominions, but even if you want to go back to stuff like, say, Force Majeure, for example, or even Maranatha at the end of the first season, it's done enough that I can give it enough goodwill. I can say the fact that it's confusing, or the fact that, you know, the logic driving this isn't entirely transparent to me as a viewer, is an intentional choice on the part of the production team, and something that enriches the show because it captures the way in which life itself kind of works, where I am not party to all of the forces at work in the world. I do not always understand why things happen in the way that they do. And that is something that unsettles me and terrifies me. I mean, The X-Files is a show about conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory is about imposing a narrative or a reason on the world. It's about explaining an unexplainable event. You know, Lee Harvey Oswald killed the president, and that's terrifying. But if it was a syndicate of people who are very highly organized and who secretly run the world, that's grand, because it means that somebody's running the world and it makes sense and I can understand that. And that's what The X-Files is about. It's about, hey, look, there's a mythology. There are men in suits. They do control our fate. There is a reason why everything terrible's happening. And in contrast, Millennium is a show about, hey, there is maybe something that controls our fate, but we don't know what it is or what it wants or why it makes the decisions that it does. So in the end, isn't that just as terrifying, and perhaps even more terrifying, than the thought that the universe is arbitrary, unfair, and chaotic? And so I kind of like that, and I can go along with it, and I can understand why borrowed time would, like, not be to everybody's tastes. But to me, this is my jam. And I am very much on board with it.
Yeah, I mean, I am as well. I mean, I think the what I really like about it, about the, you know, not laying out on the table, I love, like, things like that. I love the fact that you don't have to have things explained to you. And I think that Samil does a good job of relating to stuff that you're not necessarily understanding at the time. So, as you say, going back to that that obnoxious guy saying he could walk quicker. His the way that he does react is like, because one of the questions I was going to ask was the actual event itself, the train itself, he knows that's going to happen. But it's the little things that he seems to be able to control. What's the reasoning behind that? You know, is there a higher power? We've seen plenty of TV shows that do this kind of thing where, you know, is it fate that train's going to go there? You can only change the minute details. Is it like what you said, like I said, with Millennium, that in fact of 1919, that these people in particular have to be saved? And the fact that he's walking in there, he can't mess with Three Will, for example. Yeah. And the fact that guy's turned up and it's like, right, okay, so I have to like change things around to make sure this happens. So is the engine fault? Yeah. Is it Samuel doing that, for example, to make them move? So I like all that. I like the fact that it makes you think and you can make you wonder. And I think it does a really good job of doing that. And it really does is a testament for me in that way that it does do that. And obviously the pay it forward thing, one of my questions would be is that surely that must have started somewhere. And is Samuel like just stuck because and that's his one and only job, and he's been stuck it from, you know, from thousands of years in the past, yeah, you know, forever. That he's had, that's his one thing.
I kind of love the idea that he screwed up like once, that like the initial event was like an accident and he kind of messed up on his first day on the job. And like whatever divine authority exists in the world of Millennium is like, right, you are going to fix this if it takes you forever. And I'm not talking abstractly, I mean forever. And it does raise the question then of like, what happens after this? Like, what happens to Samuel's borrowed time? Like, is there now somebody who's got, like, not to jump ahead to, the end of the episode, but, like, does somebody have to kind of jump in and is like, somebody else going to be assigned this caseload? It reminds me a lot of the Adjustment Bureau, actually, which I really quite enjoyed, kind of the Matt Damon movie, which, again, has this kind of a similarly absurd kind of premise and this kind of, like, wonderful film noir aesthetic that underpins what's actually a kind of a very heavy-handed religious metaphor. Even though it makes absolutely no sense. But yeah, there's that real kind of like, you could kind of pick at it and you could kind of wonder how it works. And I think that's, you know, and again, I wonder if I would be less forgiving if I didn't like Johannesson's other scripts as much or if I didn't like the rest of Millennium as much. But I like that there's enough room there to play with. It feels intentional and it feels like something that adds to the show, that it's not explained in the way that like, you know, even on The X-Files, it would be. You know, on The X-Files, you'd have a montage. Yeah. You'd have pictures. You'd have a moment where Mulder goes to a library and there are pictures of Samuel going back to like 1947 and he hasn't aged a day or something like that, you know? Whereas in here, it's just like, no, we're not going to give you any details. You're just going to have to figure it out as you go. And if there are any gaps, well, they were intended. So don't ask any questions or do ask questions, but just don't expect any answers.
Yeah, well, that in itself opens a couple of questions for me. one would be talking about the allusions to like sort of seeing people in the past. I mean, we've seen that in Lucy Butler in A Room with No View, for example. So there's a tenuous link in within that as well with Samuel and how that happened. But my second question, just while it comes to mind, is the one thing I think I would have liked more in this episode. I think it could have. It does it, but it doesn't do it as strong as what I would have liked, is the reason why he gave up. Because it's a case of, like, he's doing it almost for Frank because of what he's seen, but I don't think it's strong enough in the script and what we see on screen to really warrant that payoff. It doesn't really hit. I know we're talking about the end here, but I think it does have that question of, yes, I can see where they were going with it, but I don't think it hits as hard as what it could.
Yeah, no, it's very much going for like the Book of Job kind of like effect, particularly where you have like Frank turning to heaven and literally lamenting and asking if what he's done, surely that has to be enough at some point. But yeah, you're right that you never get a sense of Samuel himself kind of. And again, it's somewhat ambiguous as to whether it's Samuel himself who makes the choice or some other entity, because he's going to swim out, but it seems like he's locked in, which would lead you to believe that maybe it's some other force that's doing it. But he's then also like the fact that he counts, which again is very similar to what he does with the other victims as well, implies that he is cognizant of this as well. And it's never made entirely clear, like, who makes. Is it a decision that's made? Who makes the decision?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, And again, you can understand, like, within the logic of the story, because you know how stories are told, that, like, Samil or somebody has been profoundly moved by Frank's suffering and his angst and his effort to communicate with them. But, like, at the same time, you have to imagine that, like, Samil has heard his fair share of sob stories, like, logically, just based on, like, sheer mathematical numbers, is that, like, everybody, or most people, I am fairly sure. Although, yeah, it does feel rather mean-spirited that they're like, oh yeah, don't worry, one of these guys was a shut-in. And it's like, okay, are we implying that his time was worth less than somebody else's? But that's a whole other kettle of fish we're probably not going to get into. It may also be an allusion to Seven as well, I think, has something kind of similar going on there as well. But it does feel very pointedly unclear. It feels like, as you pointed out, something that, like, you can see what the script is going for, but there's never that moment of connection. There's never that moment where it's made clear. And again, part of me wonders, like the opening scene, how would you make what this episode is trying to say clear visually on screen? Would you have, like, a thunderstorm break out as Frank turns to the heavens and laments and asks, haven't I given enough? As a lightning bolt cracks across the sky. Like thunder rages outside. A bush burns outside the hospital inexplicably. But yeah, I think that, you know, there was probably a way to communicate more clearly what was going on, and the episode missed it. And I do think that is a problem. That is actually, like, legitimately a problem. I like the ambiguity, but that is a narrative shortcoming on the part of the episode.
Yeah, because you'd think that the conversation when they have outside the hospital is the point. That's the point there. And obviously, as you say, the call into the heavens when Frank's really suffering with what's happening to Jordan is kind of like the final part of it. But that first part of him talking to Samuel doesn't really
land.
It doesn't land like as big as it needs to land. Whereas other parts of the episode does, you know, things like the sheer horror of Frank having to deal with putting Jordan into the ice bath, which is, as I say, kind of that emotive stuff that they've put throughout this episode. I think those moments hit really, really well. I think the ice bath does, and obviously the end with the allusion to Catherine as well. I think both of them do work, and there's a testament to the episode, because that's, like, at the end of the day, is the center of this episode.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I mean, Lance Henriksen's work here is amazing. And again, even Brittany Tiplady as sort of Jordan does remarkable work as well. And the episode really, again, leans very heavily on their dynamic and their relationship. And even little things like the one whole sequence where he's like, I'll make you some chicken soup. And she's like, you don't know how to make that as well. Which, again, you know, perhaps alludes to the fact that, you know, this wasn't Frank's traditional role in the very, you know, traditional black family. He kind of went out to work or whatever, you know, and I know Catherine had her job as kind of a social worker and stuff like that. But, like, in the context of Millennium, it was always Catherine that you saw at home while Frank was away. And so this idea that you have of, like, underscoring the absence of Catherine even before you kind of overtly bring her into the narrative by underscoring the fact that, like, Frank is trying very hard and Frank is, like, being the best father he can be. But even in small touches, like not knowing how to make chicken soup when his daughter's sick, is an illustration of kind of like the idea that they are still figuring this out. And again, that stuff is very, very well written and handled very well. And even the sequence where he's trying to put her in the bath. And again, it's something that if the episode, it's a testament to how well the episode's constructed, because Jordan needs to go in the ice bath and she ends the scene in the ice bath, but you hold up the scene. Like, you delay the scene for a solid minute because you want that interaction between Frank and Jordan. You want Frank to be protective of Jordan. And then you also want to show that Frank understands that she needs to go into the ice, and you have to understand and show Frank's empathy in trying to convince her that she needs to go into the ice and try to hold her and comfort her in a situation that, you know, for any child is an absurd and horrifying situation in the place. It's we mentioned how vague and abstract all the kind of metaphysical stuff is. I think the episode works in large part because that dynamic is grounded. That dynamic kind of feels lived in and feels well observed and actually feels like a human father and daughter interacting with one another, which in the context of an episode where one of the characters may be an angel, is very important. It's very important that you get the small details right if you're going to play as fast and loose with the big ones, I think. And I think that's why I like the episode so much. if it didn't nail those small interactions with Frank and Jordan, if it didn't sell those beats, it wouldn't work nearly as well as it does. Even small things like him calling her Supergirl, which gives you kind of that warmth that is often kind of like, particularly in third season, but is often missing from Frank, who's always kind of constantly on edge, obviously after the trauma of what happened. But you get this kind of instant warmth from him, which really sells like the stakes of the episode in emotional terms. It's remarkably well constructed in that sense, which I don't know whether it makes the kind of larger, the kind of stuff we were just discussing more or less infuriating, but it is kind of interesting to contrast.
Yeah, I mean, it's even like the touch of like when you turn 13, it's going to feel like an eternity. Yeah. You know, that whole thing of like, will we stay together forever? You won't want me at 13 years old, trust me, which was a nice little touch as well. I did allude to Lucy Butler, so I just wanted to get your opinion on the, because this obviously, there's a number of different things happening in Millennium as a whole. So we've got Lucy Butler in the episodes that we've got her in, and she obviously appears in two this season. And you've got Samuel, but you've also got the other versions or other beings as such that have appeared throughout the show. How do you think that I wouldn't say, I'm not going to say links in, but how do you think thematically it works as a Millennium episode with that kind of aspect?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is one of the things where Millennium is so fast and loose that maybe they're all connected or maybe they're not. Maybe they're all the same character or maybe they're not. And there's no real way to make that kind of connection between the two. Again, like it's worth noting that, you know, the character of Samael is very similar to the character of Samael, who appears in Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions, in that he seems to answer to a higher authority that Frank has no control over. You know, there's a sequence where he ends up in custody, but Frank can't really hold him anyway. And the sense in which he's operating or playing by rules that Frank doesn't entirely understand, and which terrify Frank. And again, his narrative function, even in terms of how the episode goes, is quite simple as well, in that it, you know, it's quite similar to Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions as well. So it feels like a conscious mirroring, and that, you know, with the names kind of mirroring one another as well. And you could argue that even the angel who appears in kind of Midnight of the Century as well, who is also kind of similarly obsessed with death. I mean, he hangs out in a graveyard and like is aware of people who are about to die and kind of customs relating to the soon to be deceased as well. So I think like, as much as you can connect the various Lucy Butlers who appear, although to be honest, the casting really helps there, where you can say that this character genuinely is Lucy Butler. But as much as you can kind of like filter those characters together and try and narrow them down into one idea of what evil is, you can kind of do the same with Samael and Samael. And you can say that they are this entity that recurs throughout Millennium is like the different face of the same basic idea. Which is this idea of kind of like there are laws that govern the universe, and particularly that govern the passage and allocation of time and death and the, you know, death and rebirth and the idea of survival that exists beyond human comprehension. Because again, I think it's worth noting Samael probably took his name from Samael, who is an older biblical angel as well. And there's a really good essay, I think, from Alexander Zenyev. I think it's called Seeing Evil, and I think it's in Back to Frank Black. But he mentions that the angel Samael, who obviously shares kind of a similar name to the character from this episode, the character from Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominion, is the angel of death, and basically is responsible for dealing death. And he appears as the angel of death in Talmudic lore, and he's regarded as both good and evil. He's neither one nor the other. And again, that sense that runs through Millennium as well, because I think one of the interesting aspects of Millennium is that obviously Lucy Butler is evil and the devil is evil. And it's been obvious since the pilot and since Gehenna. You know, people call it the Legion arc. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But there is a sense watching Millennium that there is an evil entity at work in the world, corrupting people and causing pain and causing suffering. What's interesting about Millennium is that the flip side isn't always true, in that when a divine authority appears, or a more powerful authority appears, it isn't always presented as benign. It isn't always presented as something that favors Frank Black. It isn't always presented as something that offers kind of a clear guide or a reprieve. It's typically presented as something alien, something other, and often something kind of quite hostile. Like, I mean, to pick a couple of examples, it's most obvious in 1919, where, you know, you mentioned the children and the future and the idea that the savior of mankind is on board this bus. But at the same time, like, whatever is controlling the world, whatever force is guiding the universe, has decided that the child is going to die in a tornado. Mankind's future is going to be wiped out. There's no real sense that, you know, if you want to call it God in the world of Millennium, or whatever divine authority exists, is particularly invested in protecting mankind. In, like, The Curse of Frank Black, for example, you know, the episode, like, really great second season episode where Frank, like, meets, you know, Mr. Crosil as the embodiment or representative of, like, the forces down below. There's never any angel that appears to him to say, don't worry, Frank, keep fighting the good fight, we'll look out for you. There's no entity like that. Instead, when characters that are angelic appear, they largely exist in that kind of Old Testament rather than New Testament sort of way, where they appear as representatives of something that exists beyond human comprehension. If you're being charitable, you would say that they exist beyond the conception of good and evil, but they often seem, you know, actively hostile, if not malicious, towards humanity, or indifferent even towards humanity, and more interested in preserving some sort of weird cosmic balance. Now, to be fair, and this is where I think Johannesson is interesting, you know, towards a grand unified theory of Chip Johannesson's Millennium episodes. Johannesson is interesting because he says, or he's more interested in this idea of balance than in death. And again, this is, I think, the point at which, say, the third season maybe begins to develop a theme or a core thesis that is interesting, and particularly in relation to the second season. We'll maybe talk in a moment about how Borrowed Time relates to the second season. But Johannesson's episodes tend to portray these divine messengers or these divine forces a bit less indifferent to human suffering than other episodes. So I mentioned, you know, The Curse of Frank Black, I mentioned 1919, Midnight of the Century as well. But if you want to talk about Johannesson episode, it's worth noting that in Arcadia Ego, which I think was the second season episode, you know, the divine authority there decides to offer two lesbian prisoners an immaculate conception, basically, a miraculous pregnancy. And here, you have, you know, again, we mentioned it's not done with a great deal of elegance, but you have Samil being moved by, like, the plight of Frank Black to the extent that he or somebody decides that his life will be sacrificed in place of Jordan's. So there is that kind of weird sense of warmth and balance. And again, like, when I mentioned that thesis statement or this idea of the third season developing a theme that is unique and responding to the second season Millennium is essentially all about death. And I mean, you know, listeners are probably sick and tired of hearing me talk about it. We're not going to do that again. But, like, the idea of, you know, the idea that the end of the world is the apocalypse is a big recurring theme in the second season on both a personal and a global level. Like, throughout the second season, it's about worlds ending. Sometimes those worlds are literal. Sometimes those worlds are personal, such as in, say, The Pest House, where a person's individuality and personality is erased along with the evil inside of them. Sometimes the world ends when a community is broken up, as in, you know, with the allegations in, say, Monster, or with the kind of tribe in A Single Blade of Grass, for example. And sometimes the end of the world is like the breakdown of a family unit, as happens with the Black family over the course of the season. But the idea is that, like, in the second season, the world is always ending, and the world will always end. And, you know, it will end for everybody. It will just end in different ways. What's interesting about the third season, and I promise I would say really nice things, so here is the nicest thing I think that I have ever said about the third season. In the third season, you see a response to that. And the response to that is the idea that death cannot exist in isolation. Not everything. Everything dies, maybe. But death is inexorably tied to life. There is death, but there is also a resurrection. There is a cosmic balance between the two forces. You know, the second season of Millennium is about decay, destruction, collapse. The third season of Millennium says, well, actually, if the universe is collapsing, decaying, and if death is certain, then inevitably something must be born from it. And I mean, even in, say, Exegesis, which is an episode I do not particularly like, but Johannesson kind of argues that the end of the world is just one possible outcome. There are other possible outcomes that can be seen as well. And, like, here you have the idea that, you know, when somebody dies, well, that's okay. Not that's okay, but as a result, other people live. And so there is this kind of giving and back and forth between them. And again, you could argue it's a very Eastern philosophy. It's a very, like, as opposed to a Judeo-Christian approach, it's something more in step with, you know, what we associate with Buddhism, this idea of kind of like the constant circle of life, the kind of the idea of reincarnation and perpetual movement, and the idea that we progress and journey, not in a kind of a linear fashion, but in a circular movement. And again, it's notable that, like, in this context, Johannesson later in the season will write Bardo Thodol, which is explicitly tied to Tibetan philosophy. And again, to be absolutely clear, I think that, like, Johannesson's grasp or Johannesson's interest in that stuff is much more interesting than a lot of the kind of contemporary fascination you see with Buddhism or with, you know, kind of Orientalism or New Ageism in contemporary Hollywood or in late 90s Hollywood, in, like, you know, The X-Files, for example, with its kind of fascination with Native American culture and kind of Native American mysticism that you see in episodes like The Blessing Way, but also even in shows like, say, Star Trek and its treatment of, say, Chakotay and Star Trek Voyager and as a vehicle for kind of New Age philosophy. I think Johannesson is genuinely interested in this idea of life and death as two sides of the same coin. And I think, like, with Borrowed Time, you actually see the third season for the first time, I would argue, make a substantive, like, argument against the second. Because, I mean, we talked about how one of the big problems with the third season is it tries to erase or ignore what came before. And when you say that, people tend to think you're being defensive. You're like, oh, you just don't like the third season because it's trying to erase the second season and you really like the second season, so therefore you don't like the third. And it's not that. There are plenty of movies and TV shows I like that directly contradict one another. I really like, say, Star Trek II, which is a story about how Kirk is over the hill and old and needs to retire. But I also really like Star Trek III, which is about how Kirk is most definitely not over the hill and shouldn't retire and is the only man who can save the universe. So thank goodness he's out there. Like, I think that the issue is that you need to say something. If you are going to rebut what came before, if you are going to reject what the previous iteration of your franchise or your story said, you need to be willing to make a positive argument. So think about, like, James Cameron's The Terminator. The first Terminator movie is about how everything is a fixed loop. We are all trapped by fate. Kyle Reese is sent back in time to protect Sarah Connor, but in the end, all he ultimately does is actually conceive John Connor. You know, the Terminator is sent back in time, and its remains lead to the creation of Skynet, which leads to Skynet sending it back in time, so nothing changes as a result. And so the Terminator is a really grim, nihilistic story about how nothing we do matters. And then Terminator 2 Judgment Day comes along, and it says, actually, what we do does matter. Everything in the last movie doesn't make sense. We're going to say that there's no fate except what we do ourselves. And it is a complete rejection of the first movie, like, down to the core philosophical level. But it doesn't mean that the first movie is bad or the second movie is good. It just means that they're arguing different points in different ways. And I think they're both brilliant movies and both brilliant stories in their own right. So what I'm guessing, in a very roundabout way, and I apologize for taking this long to get to my point, but here it is. The nicest thing Darren's going to say about the third season Millennium is that with Borrowed Time, you see Chip Johannesson argue for himself why he didn't like the second season, why he's saying something different than the second season, what he would actually say in opposition to the second season, how his philosophy is opposed to everything that you saw in the second season, and why he feels the need to push back against it. And it's the first time, 10 episodes into the third season, that the show has actually made a substantive argument about why the philosophy, the outline, the view, and the driving thematic arc behind the second season is not something that it really bought into, why it's something that it's rejecting. And I think that's important. I think that's vital. And I think that's why, like, the third season is a mess, is not because it's opposed to the second season. It's because it doesn't understand why it's opposed to the second season until we reach the halfway point. And that's far, far, far too late.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to to say it, and hopefully it's a good counselling session for you.
Very, very therapeutic. Apologies for that.
But no, I mean, I will say that Rise of the Machines also kind of like argues against
Terminator 2, of course.
Back to where it was.
Like Rise of the Machines, like then goes, maybe they're both right, and shrugs its shoulders. It's like, maybe you can prevent Judgment Day, but only for a little while. And it's like, that's not an argument. Pick a side. Pick a lane. You can either change the past or you can't. None of this wishy-washy. You can change it sometimes, but you can't really change it. So it all balances out. Yeah, no, pick a damn side.
Yeah, I thought it was telling you didn't mention Rise of the Machines, put it that way. But now, one thing I wanted to pick up, you mentioned some, you very eloquently put, obviously, about the death thing, but there is an obsession around this death about the various areas that he's going to. He's going to these near-death experience groups and stuff, and that he's seeing that in his world. Obviously, that's where he gets in there. But I wanted to talk briefly just about the empathy in this episode as well, because even at the very beginning of the episode, Frank and Emma find out this episode very much, very, very much like Mulder and Scully would find this episode. It's like the mail's been diverted to accidentally to Frank and Emma. But what I quite like about it is that Emma's portrayal through this, even at the point of the opening of the episode, is that her empathy actually shines through this episode. It's quite nice the way that she's portrayed in this, that she's worried about Frank, that there's elements to her story that you know, obviously it's building up to the point of later on in season 3-4 of how, where she's going to be in her dilemma. But it's not the way that Mulder and Scully would go about it at the very beginning of this episode. It's very kind of more empathetic as such, the way that Emma is portrayed there. And it is an interesting discussion that Emma's kind of given a bit more to do with Frank being, again, in some ways, like earlier on in the season where Emma's having to pull Frank out of the mire because of where he is in the world of After the Time Is Now. This one's more of a concern, and I do like that. And also that leads into where Samuel's actually in the hotel apartment, and his empathy for, you know, the person that he's obviously taking this time back from, and that he does phone the police, and he does change his voice and all that kind of thing. And I do like those the empathetic tones that they have.
Yeah, no, there's a surprising like warmth and compassion to it as well, which again seems to exist in stark contrast to the rather grim conclusion like of the second season. And again, it's notable not to dwell too heavily. Darren talking about the third season Millennium won't shut up about the second season Millennium, but it is worth noting that like some of the lines from Samil are actually like consciously mirroring Mr. Lott's observation in The Time Is Now, where like Mr. Lott says, you know, maybe individually we are allotted only so many days of life, maybe as a whole mankind is only allotted so many days of life. And like it's interesting that this is a response to that Samil like works on the theory that there is apparently only so much time that you can allocate in the world to people, but like still argues in contrast to Mr. Lott that there's empathy there. There's room for compassion there, that there's room for him to be moved by it. And that like, maybe like that there, maybe the universe like can be nudged. Maybe the universe can find room for compassion and for empathy and for warmth. Like that sequence with the, you know, with the group, where the group are talking about their near-death experiences as well, is also profoundly moving, because you have this big monologue given to one of those people who went through a near-death experience, where she talks about knowing that there must be a reason, or there must be something beyond, or there must be a purpose to it, which is, again, in the context of the third season Millennium being about Frank and Jordan dealing with the loss of Catherine. And again, even before Catherine is mentioned in the episode, you know, her absence is repeatedly kind of, the audience's attention is drawn to her absence and her loss and the kind of implied effect that is having on Frank and Jordan as a family unit trying to survive. But like in that context, you have the idea of how important it is to believe that there is something more, or that there is something that feels something that operates beyond like cold mathematics, something that operates beyond the allocation of days, like it's shifting, you know, a schedule at work, something that actually cares and something that actually has empathy or warmth or forgiveness or understanding of what it is to be a living person. And I think that, that I think that's genuinely important. I think that you're right. I mean, you mentioned this is a very emotional episode. This is a very emotional episode. There's a warmth to this episode, which is very surreal, given that, you know, we're talking about an episode which features an angel that just takes time from some people and allocates to others, or looms over them, or kind of like leads to people suffocating or drowning in the park or drowning in their bed, you know, or wants Jordan to die drowning. But like, despite those stakes and despite those setups, there's a, in the way that is only really possible, I think, on Millennium, there's a humanity there. There's an empathy, there's a compassion, and there's a warmth. And I think that stands to the episode's credit. And I think it's part of why it's that dream logic that you mentioned works as well as it does, because, you know, the episode is about wanting to believe that there is a plan behind the way the world is, or there's a plan behind how people leave the world, or what happens to them after they leave the world. And like, you know, watching this episode, you get a sense that even if I don't understand this episode, I kind of also want to believe that there's a plan behind it, because there is an empathy there that we pointed to. There is a warmth there that we pointed to. I think it works very well.
Yeah, and I think the way that, I mean, obviously this comes from people's stories of near-death experiences, but the way that the acceptance is drawn within this episode, with the, you know, when she does say about, you know, that they're happy to go, the very first scene when we go into the morgue, and into the morgue,
oh, with her son,
and the group as
with
well.
Her son, so it's, and the autopsy. Yes,
yeah, so they're all accepting all, because he says that she was ready to go, and she and everyone in that near death experience group are saying they are ready when it's their time. So I like the fact that they've gone beyond that moment. And obviously, you know, Jordan right at the very end is as you mentioned the Catherine element, that, you know, she's seen Frank, and Frank's getting the you know, the reinforcement of that. The right choice was made, and that's almost like, for him, that's like his thing of, like, you know, acceptance of it, you know, the fact that he can accept that death and hopefully and potentially move on. So I think it's from that, as you say, the warmth really works well in that.
Yeah,
in that
and
regard.
I mean, it is worth noting that, like, you know, again, this is the entire third season in a capsule, because, you know, regardless of what the Innocence and Exegesis decided happened at the end of the second season, the end of the second season did feature the end of the world. You know, the world has gone through its own near-death experience in Millennium. The show itself has arguably gone through its own near-death experience. So, you know, there's something kind of like very clever and very appropriate about this being an episode about what it's like to come out the other side of that. Because the show really has. The show has inexplicably kind of come out the other side of that, and has, you know, arguably through continuity resets, maybe cheated a little bit. But the idea that, you know, last year it was all about death and building to this big idea of death. So the third season by default is inevitably about, well, what happens after death, or what happens after you were supposed to die and you didn't. You know, again, the joke here is that Millennium itself is on borrowed time in terms of, like, its impending fate from the network. But in terms of the show itself, like, the show literally ended its last season with the end of the world. You know, it makes sense that the theme that carries over into the third season is one of, well, what happens after that? Where do you go after that? And again, you know, I think it's one of the big problems of the third season is that it takes this long for the writing staff to actually come to terms with that it takes Chip Johannesson this long to kind of step into the gap. And I think that, like, it's notable that even here, like, you can tell that the show is nervous about it. It's not entirely sure how to approach the end of the second season, like, whether it can approach it directly or indirectly. It seems to be doing most of it abstractly. So you have, for example, you know, the casting of kind of the CDC doctor, as well, who's like the CDC doctor who appeared in The Time Is Now implicitly. Same role. You know, it's the guy who's brought in to be the disease expert. And apparently, like, his scene could be cut. There is no reason for him to be in this episode, really. You could have any other actor in the role. You don't even actually need that scene. You could just have, you know, Frank read a piece of paper that says, oh, by the way, there's no evidence of any disease or contagion. But having that Bill... Is it Bill Dow, the actor? Having him present there, basically... Chuck Burks, yeah, if you're an X-Files fan. But having Chuck Burks present, but having Bill Dow present is a way of kind of going, oh, hey, remember the last time Bill Dow was on Millennium? Oh, yeah, that was a really messed up time, wasn't it? Or even little details like, you know, the fact that Jordan, you know, is suffering from what appears initially to be a relapse of an illness that was, you know, we're going to be very clear here, not the illness that affected mankind at the end of last season, but which cannot help but evoke the memory of the last time Millennium was particularly concerned about a disease that might kill Jordan. And particularly in the context, and again, like the episode, and I like this because it feels like it builds to it. It feels like the episode kind of earns it because you have the confrontation between Frank and Samil where Frank quite literally says, like, you know, Catherine traded her life for Jordan's. She made a choice, which is one of the, like, this is, that's perhaps the most direct that the kind of third season has acknowledged, the end of the second season. It's the most direct embrace of what happened, or the most literal acknowledgement of kind of what happened in very real and substantive terms. And what that does, that moment between Frank and Samil does, is it says, well, actually, isn't that what this whole episode is ultimately about? Isn't this whole episode about this idea of balancing and sacrifice and one life over the other? And therefore, like, it becomes a kind of a reopening or a re-legislating of the end of the second season. Because, you know, instead of Catherine making the choice to give Jordan the vaccine and to die herself, you have Samil saying, okay, well, I've only got so much time to allocate for somebody to live, somebody else has to die, but it's very much the same choice. And I think there's something quite clever in that. I think there's something like, again, you can feel that the show is, and again, part of me wonders if maybe there's something behind the scenes where maybe Carter didn't want the show to directly or overtly or explicitly acknowledge the second season, or maybe the network was like, okay, well, look, you can't really mention that, you know, you almost wiped out the entire world population last season. Just brush it under the carpet because that'll create too much continuity issues or too many continuity issues. But it really does feel that with Borrowed Time, Johannesson is basically metaphorically playing out like the central arc of like that season finale. And in doing so, he's like bringing 10 episodes into the third season. He's bringing the second season into play. He's bringing the ideas behind the second season into play. He's bringing the thematic dynamics behind it. So that, like, by the end of the episode, when you reach that scene with Jordan, where Jordan, like, acknowledges Catherine and acknowledges Catherine's passing and has Catherine, you know, say, you know, you're doing the best you can, and I still love you. It feels like it's earned because it's really the first time. Like, even including Innocence and Exegesis, inexplicably enough, it's the first time the third season has really acknowledged that, has really confronted that, and has really kind of like looked at it head on and said, okay, yeah, this is what we're dealing with the fallout of. And again, it's notable that like this kicks off what I would argue the strongest three episodes of the season, which are, you know, this, Collateral Damage, and The Sound of Snow, all of which are in their own way about, like, as the third season confronting what happened with the second, realizing or kind of dealing or processing with the consequences of the second season of Millennium. And I think, you know, the third season, I would argue, is handicapped by the fact that this happens, you know, 10 episodes into the season. But it's interesting to see Johannesson bring that stuff in abstractly and indirectly and kind of metaphorically rather than literally, rather than relying on continuity or, you know, explicit references or characters talking at length in monologue, or, you know, bring back Terry O'Quinn or involving the Millennium Group or anything as overt as that. Instead, he just says, well, actually, if you break it down, this is what the second season finale was about. So let's find a way to construct a story that deals with those themes, and having helped the audience navigate through those themes and those ideas, when we get to the end, we can actually say, hey, yeah, remember the second season? That was a lot, wasn't it? And like, it feels earned. It feels like genuinely earned. And I think that's what I really like about this episode. I think that's like underneath all the, not, you know, the bits that don't make sense and kind of the logic that doesn't quite fit, the dream logic that you mentioned, the fact that it's, you know, very vague on what are admittedly important points. The fact that it basically says, well, okay, the second season is something that happened. And, you know, we may not be able to say it's something that literally happened in the continuity of the show anymore, but it is something that happened emotionally to the characters. That's something that we have to acknowledge and make our peace with and confront and explore. And I think that's important for the show going forward. And I think it is, it's, you know, there's a reason why Borrowed Time, I would argue, represents a kind of a turning point for the third season. I think the third season gets a lot stronger after this point. I think it becomes a lot more solid. I think that, you know, a lot of the third season's reputation with certain segments of fandom is based primarily on the episodes leading up to Borrowed Time. That maybe meant that when the show hit this point, it didn't get a fair shake from viewers or from fans because, you know, the well had been tainted. And I think that, you know, I think Borrowed Time does a lot of heavy lifting, and it kind of deserves credit, I think, for doing that heavy lifting.
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of like compare this to, say, the likes of Skull and Bones, which personally, for me, I actually really, really like Skull and Bones. You know, you've got the very straightforward, out there discussion of what the Millennium Group are, and to tackle what had happened in season two with The Time Is Now would be a quite a difficult task. And I completely agree that using this in a more thematic way and the kind of the mystic and the kind of, you know, the, as I say, the dreamscape in which it's playing in, I think works really well. And I think it's perfect because you're dealing with more of an emotional stance rather than something in Skull and Bones, which is more about a statement to the world of like what the Millennium Group is. So there's that difference, but I do like having the twin attack on that, really, because you've got the two things flowing in one direction, and both obviously will collide in various different aspects over the course of the season, like you mentioned collateral damage, for example. So it is interesting from that point of view that you do have the two working together. But yeah, it's certainly an interesting one. I'm going to change tax unless you've got anything you want to just come back on that.
No worries. You're taking that turn, are you? You're going off.
I'm taking that turn.
It's gone completely off the grid.
I'm going completely off the grid, and I'm saying two things. One, Blade Runner, let's find something in a mirror and then talk about a watch, which is clearly non-existent. And two, that E-fit is horrific. And it's amazing just how good that E-fit is, how much it looks like him.
But I mean, the nose, they did have to change the nose, which I kind of quite like. We don't want to make this too easy or too obvious that we're just taking the actor's face and cutting it up into little pieces and having Frank Black arrange it so it looks just like the actor. So, yeah, I do kind of love that they're like, no, what if we give him a funny nose first? Like, yeah, we can do that. That's grand. That'll make it. It's like, you know, that kind of like in movies where they always get it on their second guess when you're hacking a password. Because if you got it on the first guess, yeah, it's too easy. It seems unbelievable. So it's like, yeah. We give him a nose. No, not that nose. What about this nose? Yep, that's the nose. And it's like, yep, got him perfectly. I do kind of love as well that he's just hanging around the group as well when Emma shows up as just waiting to be arrested as well. And yeah, I kind of like look that he gives the camera where it's like, yep, this is my portfolio shot. This is going on the reel. And it's like, okay, that's a very sexy angel. Very late yeah, 90s angel.
Absolutely. And I think something that I would like to just bring up just as a nice little touch within the episode is when Samuel is actually in the interrogation room, which is a lovely interrogation. They always seem to, in Millennium, they tend to take him to the boardroom. I'm not quite sure why they do that. but never mind. But I do like the actual fact that, you know, it kind of reflects back on some of season one as well, that he's put himself in that position. He knows exactly what he's doing. I'd say that Lucy Butler kind of thing as well. But the fact that the staring, the winking at Frank, and the only thing I would touch upon is that characterization of him. I feel maybe slightly off. I think I would have liked to have him be not as
playful or flirty. You know, stupid flirty, yeah, sexy angel.
Yeah. I just didn't really buy that. I would have liked him to be a bit more distant and be a bit more aloof than what he is. But I do actually physically like that scene, though, the fact that, and it's beautifully done with the way you can just about see Frank through the window.
I mean, there's a little bit where Frank punches him later on as he's leaving, and he kind of like licks the kind of like takes the thumb and rubs the kind of bleeding lip as well. And that's a real sort of like, I'm kind of into this kind of moment, which is like, again, not necessarily what you would expect from the portrayal of, again, and I keep calling him an angel. I think he is an angel. I think it's safe to call him an angel, but still, whatever the hell he is, it's still a very odd beat to play. It's kind of like Edward Norton in Fight Club moment.
I mean, other than that, I don't really have anything else. I mean, there's bound to be other things within the episode itself, but is there anything you want to bring up that I may have missed over the course of the episode?
We did mention, we did compare Samuel and Lucy Butler actually as well. And it is worth noting very, very quickly, and I promise this will actually be quick. The angel Samuel, who I mentioned, has been linked to the demon Lilith, and the demon Lilith obviously is linked to Lucy Butler as well in kind of function, form, and metaphor throughout the show's run. And according to, I think it's a treatise on left emanation from the 13th century, traditionally it's been seen that Samael and Lilith were born as one, similar to Adam and Eve, reflecting, you know, one above and one below. So it's kind of interesting that if you want to read Lucy Butler as a stand-in for Lilith in terms of your theology, and you want to read Samael as kind of a stand-in for Samael, then that they serve kind of two mirror functions of one another. I think that's kind of, you know, again, maybe reading too much into it. Maybe that's not entirely intended, and maybe it's not entirely earned, but I do think that there is something nice in that reflection of the kind of two characters. The idea that they're, you know, that Samael might be, you know, a less frequently seen, but no less effective kind of stand-in for the forces. And again, we use the word opposite. They're not moving opposite Lucy Butler, but they're kind of maybe moving in parallel with Butler. Maybe that's the way to phrase it. But they're basically moving towards different ends or with different purposes, but in a similar manner to Lucy Butler. So I think that there's something kind of nice in that. And again, it could do with... could it do with more explaining, or do I like the fact that it's not explained? Again, this is the Darren Asks Rhetorical Questions podcast. I'm not sure, but I kind of like it.
I think I like it the way it is. I think you're right with it. I think the discussion that what you said earlier on about the fact that it's not an angel demon on your shoulder kind of story, and the fact that you mentioned there that are they in opposition to? It's just that they live in the same universe as each other, I think is quite good, because, you know, I'm not so keen on, you know, this is the devil, this is the thing. I like the fact that, you know, it's a bit ambivalent in that, and the fact that there's more grey area than that. And I think that living in the same universe works for me, and that ambiguity works really well for me. So that caused the episode to an end. If there's nothing else that you want to bring up?
No, aside from the fact that Samuel probably seems like he hangs out in the good place, actually, and how that you mentioned, when you're describing like working in opposition, it really does seem like kind of like a good place. It, like, was Millennium secretly a good place spin-off, or is the good place secretly a Millennium spin-off? That's a question I'm now asking myself.
That is a question that I'm not going to answer. let's have a look on the mailbag. There's a couple of comments in the mailbag, so we shall go and do that now. Right, on Twitter, just got the one from our ever-present Oscar Groucho, our angel himself. A gorgeous meditation on loss and the footprints we leave behind. One of Clea Scott's finest performances, a natural bookend to season two, and glorious iconography. What's not to enjoy?
Yep. Pretty much all that. We didn't give enough credit to Clea Scott, actually. She does really good work here. I think she's very good in that scene with Frank where she's like, you know, I have to report you. And she's like, and he's like, then report me. And she's like, I'm not going to report you. Which is I don't always feel like Emma got the best development. I don't think that her relationship with Frank was always developed as well as it might have been. But little moments like that work really well. And I think both leads sell those moments really well. And kind of like, I would like to see more of that. I would have liked to have seen much more of that in the third season. Just like Frank being a grouchy old man, Emma being really like understandably and justifiably frustrated with how cranky and obstinate and like uncooperative Frank is being, but also like pointing out that she's not going to like sell him down the river, no matter how ornery he might seem. I like that dynamic between the two of them.
It's like, come on, Dad, just calm yourself down.
Get in the car, we're going shopping. So I don't want to go shopping. You say that every time.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I agree. I mean, in fact, I think that Clear Scott does amazing stuff in here, and I think this is not underplayed. It's just nicely played. You know, it's not over the top or anything like that at all. So Paige Schechter's been on, and she says Chip's first script since the change in showrunner points towards where one of my favorite components of the season, specifically, and the series as a whole, was headed, namely the Frank and Jordan relationship. It's probably the strongest through line of the series, and the idea that Jordan has at least a variation of what Frank does never fails to intrigue. I think it could have kept the Millennium Engine running for years. Yeah, I mean, that's something we haven't really touched upon about the gift as such, because it gets mentioned a few times, and it's even referenced in the book at the beginning. But what about Jordan and the gift and the fact that she's been affected so much in this episode?
I mean, again, it's interesting in terms of the gift, because it's that book by the philosopher. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But the idea was very popular in the late 90s. The idea that, like, the gift is tied to these sort of, like, metaphysical concepts. And the idea that the gift isn't ever really free. Like, when you get a gift, it doesn't come without any strings attached. There's always an obligation to it as well. And again, like, in the terms of using the word the gift to talk about what Frank has, or Frank's gift in inverted commas, I think the show itself has made this point repeatedly, but the idea that it's not really a gift so much as an obligation that comes with the ability, even though we call it that way. Sorry, it's French sociologist Marcel Mauss, by the way, apologies for that. But he said, basically, yeah, there's no such thing as a free gift, and that, you know, the concept of gift giving is tied up in ideas of reciprocal exchange, and how actually I think one of his observations was that people, like, if you give a gift to somebody without any strings attached, it makes them deeply uncomfortable because they assume that there's an attempt to create a reciprocal feeling, and that makes them feel unusual, and it kind of may sour the dynamic rather than help the dynamic as well. And so, yeah, in the context of Millennium as well, in the context of Frank's gift in inverted commas, it feels like a logical extension of that idea, because part of the deal with Frank's gift is that it hurts him, but it helps other people, and it comes with an obligation, a responsibility to use it to make the world a better place. So I do think that there is something interesting there as well. And then, like, you know, you can logically extrapolate that out and say, you know, in the context of borrowed time, is your life a gift? Is, you know, is the time that you get a gift? And if so, does it create an onus or an obligation on you to, like, put it to good use, or to use it wisely, or to kind of invest it well? Like, is the fact that you are, and again, this is something I think about a lot in terms of COVID-19, and particularly in terms of, you know, again, we mentioned at the start of the podcast, the idea that, you know, this is not a good time for anybody. And, you know, obviously I feel it as badly as anybody else. I'm as lonely as anybody else. I'm as, you know, isolated, as withdrawn, as disconnected as anybody else. But, you know, at the same time, I'm very lucky. And that sense of luck that I have, does that create a sense of obligation to use that luck or that opportunity to do something with it, or to kind of to put it to good use, or to put it to purpose? And again, I think there's something very, I'm not at all suggesting that borrowed time is a inverted commas episode for our time right now. I think it's a very universal question. It's actually interesting that, yeah, just Paige mentioning that, just kind of opened up this whole avenue of discussion. But yeah, it is interesting, this idea of kind of like gift giving and like borrowed time, and how you pay that back, and whether it creates an obligation, and whether there's an onus on somebody basically to put to use a gift that they're given. And if that's the case, is it really a gift? If a gift creates an obligation, is it really a gift? Does it, you know, does that word apply? And there's a lot of stuff in there that, again, it's very metaphysical, it's very abstract. And I like, one of the hallmarks of Johansson's script is that it's full of all this stuff that you can unpack as much as you want, that you can kind of delve into it, that, like, the fact that a conductor or a driver of the train can be seen for a couple of seconds reading a book by a French sociologist can lead to a tangent down the line of the idea of, like, what do we owe to the selves? And again, to bring it back to The Good Place, you know, that idea of, you know, what we owe to others.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I think, actually, speaking about that, I think it's we've actually come round full circle, strangely enough. to the very beginning of the episode. So so I think that that's probably best where we need to leave it. And as I say, we mentioned a lot about what you're kind of up to at the moment earlier in the episode, but what else have you got going on, and where can people find you online if people want to hear more of Mr. Mooney?
I imagine at the end of this episode, they've heard more than enough Mr. Mooney to get them through the long, dark winter ahead of us. But yes, you can follow me online at Darren_Mooney at Twitter. I write at the Movie Blog with a 0 instead of an O in the word movie. But if you just Google Darren Mooney, you can find it there. I've also reviewed every episode of Millennium as well. So if you want to hear me expand my thoughts at length, you can kind of read those there as well. I co-host, as I mentioned, the podcast at 250, my good friend Andrew Quinn. And I think we've been lucky enough to have Kurt North on a couple of times. I say Kurt North as if not you. We've been lucky enough to have you on, Kurt North, a couple of times over the course of kind of the pandemic as well. It's been a really wonderful experience in that sense as well. All those places you can find me online. And obviously check out The Escapists as well, because, you know, if you share those or kind of link to them or tweet them, it helps show that, you know, people like reading my stuff and they may continue to employ me.
Excellent stuff, mate. Excellent stuff. You will no doubt be back later on in the season. You're not that far away, actually. I think you're back in a few episodes' time. You're back in The Sound of Snow.
Yay!
So as I say, you mentioned it before as a trilogy of this one, Collateral Damage and Sound of Snow. But you're back with myself and Chris Knowles as well. That's going to be a great episode to listen to. But you can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. It's rmuldrake. So I'm currently doing the XCast as well, obviously our sister show. And that you can find that on the X_cast, looking at the X-Files season 6, which is interesting as well, actually. So I looked at the AV Club review, and this lines up with Tithonus.
Which they were relating to.
Which was nice. It was a nice nice little read that before coming on to this. So that was nice. And you can also find me on the Red Dwarf podcast, which is Shipwrecked and Comatose. You can find that on Twitter as well at Red Dwarf Pod. And then hopefully we should have at some point in the near future, if not already, some new further news on Star Trek Picard, the new series, or whatever information we may get depending on where we are in the whole COVID universe. And one thing I will mention is, at time of recording, is that the two mammoths, I don't know if you've seen it, Darren, the two mammoths joined forces with Mark Hamill and Patrick Stewart. Have you seen it yet?
I have not seen it.
Okay. Go and look on Twitter at Sir Patrick Stewart's Twitter account. It's an Uber Eats commercial. It's wonderful.
wow. I love that Just Eat got Snoop Dogg when Uber Eats managed to get Mark Hamill and Patrick Stewart
in the same room, and it's a marvelous little scene. But you can find the Star Trek Picard podcast, Make It So, at Jean-Luc Podard. So those are the best places to find me. You do. Every time. I just can't help but say it. I thank you very much. And next week we'll be talking Collateral Damage. But until next time, remember, everyone, this is who we are.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Cerebral Jukebox.
Yeah, because we were talking about this. We've talked about the different covers there are. Now, you yourself, I thought I'd found a nice little sort of hidden gem here, because you yourself were in a band called Bleeder, or still are in a band called Bleeder.
Yeah.
And when I was looking on Spotify just for different covers of the song, I noticed there is a cover of this by a band called Bleeder. And I was like, oh, brilliant. This is what Niall's not told me, is that he's actually done a cover of it that got released.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Maybe I'm not coming at it from an educated point of view, because, you know, not only am I a man, I'm gay. You know, I don't deal with pregnancy.
Are you?
And,
have you ever told us that before?
I was trying to make a serious point.
Hey, we love you, you know that.
Yeah. But yeah, you have got a good point, Colin. This is a bit of a sausage fest episode. Maybe we should have got a lady involved.
Real Asian Podcast.
You know, so I really do feel that there's this, and whether it's an invisible weight on our shoulders to be able to be like this ideal child, or like, you know, just being able to not drag the family name down for whatever reason, even right. if it's self-imposed.
Even if it's just completely made up in your mind.
Right. Like, you know, Brian, you were just saying about your friend who said they felt like they couldn't come out to you.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This podcast network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.